let's stand for a change for the next bit here and pray. God, we want to commit this next hour into your care, that you would be here and speak to us, speak to me, with principles of your word and your kingdom and your son and your father heart, that can be clear, refreshing, life-giving, enlightening. And lift us high, God, above this earthly mire that we live in, to godliness and Christ-likeness, beauty, nobility, and all that you could and would have put into this world had your will been fulfilled, and would it be fulfilled. So God, we want to be people that bear your name, that do things your way, that see things your way, that gladly come under your hand. We just pray that you would bless us with that gift of enlightenment and give us hearts that will rise to the best. God, we commit ourselves in your care as we always do. Have your way here with us. We ask in Christ's name, amen. I so appreciate this song. I would love thee, God and Father. Almost every word fits what I want to talk about, what I want to share. I would love thee, God and Father. So God and Father, my Redeemer and my King. The insinuations there are so strong. I would love thee, for without thee life is but a bitter thing, and I think we can all testify to that. I would love thee. Every blessing flows to me from out of your throne. I would love thee. He who loves thee never feels himself alone. I would love thee. Look upon me, my God. Ever guide me with thine eye, speaking of a posture that will obey, that will respond, that is clear, that has clarity, that is in its place. I would love thee. If not nourished by thy love, my soul would die. I would love thee. I have vowed it. On thy heart, on thy love, my heart is set. While I love thee, I will never my Redeemer's blood forget. I'll be coming back to that later. So today I'll be continuing along a similar vein than I did last time. I mentioned some aspects about training, and I put three rings up. We'll be talking about that. But today I want to talk about family, parent, children, God to us relationship. It's all the same thing. They overlap completely. When I was growing up, I heard many times that in our languages said, well, du bist undicht. And I could never get anybody to define what that was. Is that good? Is that bad? What am I doing? But I heard it enough that I'm sure I was pretty quirky. So I have memories that I don't know. It's hard to define what's normal because I only have my viewpoint. But I remember being 5, for example, and we were eating at our 3 o'clock after school time. As Hutterites, we gather and eat at 3 o'clock every day as a family, just sandwiches and tea. So we were cutting our tomato sandwiches, and what we typically do is you take the piece of bread, the sandwich, cut it down the middle, top to bottom, and you've got these two equal halves. And in my 5-year-old brain, that was just how it was done. It was always done that way. Everybody did it that way. But this one day was different. And I think I was about 5. And my brother, one of them, took the same sandwich that I'd looked at for 5 years. And he cut it not down the middle, top to bottom, but he cut it corner to corner. And for me, that was an enlightened moment. Look what he's doing. This guy, my brother, who I thought it was ordinary till now, he just made an English sandwich. This is just like the books. This is like Dick and Jane. I have never seen one in real life. This is an actual, now this is a sandwich, the triangular thing that's in books that people eat in their lunch boxes. He's got one right here. And we have all our ordinary Hutterite sandwiches. I like that one. I want this one. And to my 5-year-old brain, that was an enlightened moment. Just new information to an old situation. It was like a whole new world opened up. It wasn't dramatic, but what happened in my brain with that wow moment. So with this, what I would endeavor to do, I don't know if this will be dramatic and new, But for me, when I looked at, I've been looking through Christ's life for the last year or so, and when I looked at some aspects of his responses, how he was, what he said about his father, there is something that opened in my brain a number of months ago that has just been, I've been meditating on it and I can't seem to escape it. And it was the simple aspect of a son underneath his father's care and blessing in an absolute clear channel, no conflict. And I was thinking, if the world was like that, if that was the way that society operated, if that was the way my home operated, if that was the way the world operated, if that was the way the church operated, it would clean out so, so many issues. So there is, if we don't look at the root problem, then we can be very frustrated by endless details. I'll get to that in a bit. So the revelation, the transformation, from when I looked at that sandwich to the other one, the triangular one, and just got a brand new revelation, I feel in a way that I've looked at Christ's life and I've been missing this aspect, and it opened up to me in a way that was new for me, that I had not seen before. And as I look at parent-child relationships, I think maybe with a broader view on the whole thing, maybe the details can be clearer as we process life in the next year or so. So I said before a few messages ago, there was a, somebody had written on a high school wall, "Jesus is the answer," by somebody that was well-meaning, but somebody underneath wrote, "What's the question?" And I find that the more that I look at life and the more I look at complex situations, Jesus is the answer, and for today, he is the answer again. And you can look at his life in many, many different ways. And somehow, if you look at him and what he did and how he was, it is so, so clear of what is the right thing to do, what is the beautiful, what is the noble. So today, again, with parent-child relationships, even child training, how do you handle teenagers? What is my responsibility to God? Does a grandpa speak into a 50-year-old's life? Those things are answered very clearly, I feel, in the life of Christ. And it's not putting an artificial situation on, is the actual clearest vein that I can think of. So what should a parent-child relationship look like? What did God have in mind? When God built things, he had a very specific way that he wanted it, and he made it just right. He made it to be a channel of blessing, of rightness, of order, of beauty, of wisdom, of ingenuity, of creativity. It's all there. He put it in all of his creation, as Anthony shared yesterday. So what is the design of a parent-child relationship? What is it supposed to be like? In other words, in the perfect, in the masterpiece, in the original, in the very design, what did he want? So with our culture, we've degenerated in everything, including this one. So society isn't functioning well. And I believe this is at the core of it. If you look at the, if you're familiar with, I believe it's in Deuteronomy, where there were laws to stone a rebellious son, that is so severe. Why is that there? I believe it's that at the core of it, if you have a society where it's normal for sons to rebel against their parents, your society is doomed. You cannot operate that way. It was not meant to be that way, period. It's the same way if you have a society where men are not at home. They're just out, checked out, doing the thing. Their families are left to flow and be what they will, and the man is gone. Your society cannot function that way. So when God said, or Moses, in Moses' law, that a rebellious son cannot be part of your society, this thing is catastrophic. It cannot be. Why that severity? Because society cannot function when a core value is broken. And that is a core value. So what does a parent-child relationship look like? What are we as parents and children looking for? And I think that sometimes in looking at the details, like I said before, you can lose sight of the big picture. And in looking at the big picture, the details become clearer. And an illustration that was brought to mind was, it's a wartime illustration, and you all know how I feel about war, but just for sake of illustration, one army was moving through town, a village, and they were attempting to take it. It was a normal village in the 40s, Second World War. Medium size, lots of buildings, but it was a key point that one army needed to get to the other end of it to get out to conquer the other countryside. So they were simply moving through it and processing and taking basically street by street. And for days they had trouble. They could not move on because all over town, there was a situation where one of their key people just was killed. And then over here, whenever they tried to advance this street, they got mysterious fire. And they were held back and held back. And way over on the other end, there were people bunked down, their key people that would communicate back to the bigger base. They couldn't communicate because whenever they tried to attempt to get to the house where their radios were at, they couldn't get there because of fire, gunfire. And they couldn't figure out what the problem was because it was so varied, so different in every situation. They didn't look like they were connected. Are people hiding in tunnels? Why this mystery? Vague, we can't deal with this. We're just shut down wherever we go. And then eventually they figure out there was one sniper in a clock tower. And he basically controlled the entire town, different sections of it. And he was just shutting everything down. And once the other side figured it out, they took their tank, their war tank, and that 6-inch barrel, they turned it and swiveled and lifted and aimed, a few second pause, and they fired. And the entire clock tower, stone tower, was absolutely pulverized to dust. And then they were able to, from that point on, systematically move through and took the town. But until they dealt with the actual issue, identified it, dealt with it, then they moved on. And sometimes I feel that with what, not necessarily our church, but I'm talking broader, society, family issues, maybe our church, I don't know, but I'm not talking specifics or to anybody, but just general. In looking at a specific things, it's hard to nail down what is the problem? Why all these stumbles? And in that, if you look at the life of Christ, it tends to do what that 6-inch, 900-pound shell did and just decimate the problem. Because Christ's life is so clear, so thorough, such an example that you cannot do anything but look at it and saying that's the solution. So what are we as parents and children looking for? Once we identify the problem, you can either deal with each tiny situation or you can deal with the actual problem. So having said that, I'd like to look at Genesis 22. Turn there because I'll be flipping through the story. Genesis 22. We're looking at two fathers and two sons. It's a story that we all know, but I want to look at it because God put it here. It's important. There's a lot in here. And I'm looking at it differently. It's typically looked at upon as a sacrifice or obedience, which is all there. But I'm looking at it differently. I'm looking at it from a father and son perspective, Genesis 22:2. So here we have a story of two fathers and two sons. We have God, we have Abraham, and we have Isaac. So there are two fathers and two son relationships happening here. I'll quickly go through the story. Genesis 22:2. God tested Abraham, and he said, "Take thy son, thine only son Isaac, who you love, get thee into the land of Moriah, and offer him there for a burnt offering upon the mountains which I will tell thee of." And Abram rose early and saddled his donkey and took two of his young men with him, and Isaac his son, and clave wood. So we know they went up. We know that Abraham followed through with that command request. Isaac laid himself down. He would have literally lain there. They were communicating. They were talking. They were not fighting. God came in and said, stop. Or the angel came and said, stop. You passed the test. So in that scenario, Again, we have two fathers and two sons. But look at it not from the heartache of it, not from the awfulness of what might have happened, but look at it in the light of a father-son relationship from Abraham to God to Abraham and from Abraham to Isaac. So look at the conflict there. Putting it to our generation, can you imagine with this scenario, Isaac arguing about a curfew? Can you imagine Abraham arguing with God in a way over things that we would find conflicting, maybe hairstyle, I don't know. Just in a regular conversation with a father and a son, or a child and a mom, the lack of conflict in this situation is astounding, considering that we find ourselves in our earthly life picking at odd, little, tiny, nonsensical things. So imagine an argument between these people over whatever we conflict in. Look at how clear this one is. So what God told Abraham to do, there is no conflict. Abraham does it. It is an absolute clear channel of trust, communication, obedience. There's no rocks in that stream. If you look at Abraham to Isaac, there are no rocks or garbage or junk or sewage in that stream. It is a completely clear channel between Abraham and Isaac. There's no garbage there. It is open. It is uniform. It is unified. It is harmonious. So the two fathers and the two sons, the absolute lack of conflict there is astounding. There is no argument. There is no pushback. Nothing. Nothing. So the trust, the agreement, the order, the submission on both of them, both fathers and both sons, is very, very challenging. And for me, this message is for 8-year-olds, 12-year-olds, 15-year-olds, 25-year-olds, 43-year-olds, 50-year-olds. That channel is not, I'm not talking to teens necessarily. My point is just, what does God have in mind for parent-child relationships? And as you look at Abraham being a child, if you look at Isaac being a child, it's the exact same thing. So I'm not pinning it on young people here. I'm just saying that the whole purpose is that. And then leaving that on the pegboard, if you go to 1 Samuel, we have two fathers and three sons. In 1 Samuel, we got the story of Eli. This is a negative example. So 1 Samuel 2:22. We have the story of these two priests, these grown men. Where am I here? These two grown men, Eli's sons. Oh, I'm in 2 Samuel, sorry. So 1 Samuel 2:22. And Eli was very old and heard all of his sons did unto Israel, and how they lay with the women that assembled at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. They did many wicked things. And Eli here addresses it, and he said unto them, why do ye such things? For I hear of your evil doings by all this people. Nay, my sons, for it is no good report that I hear you make the Lord's people to transgress. So we've got God is above that, and he's Eli, I think, is kind of attempting to come under his father, God, and saying, it shouldn't be this way. So Eli was sort of attempting to push the situation. That is one side, and we've got two sons completely out of order, completely out of line, completely rebellious. So the flow there is totally broken. This stream is full of rocks, full of junk, full of sewage. That relationship is toast. It's just not happening. So they know what their father would like. They push back against him. They do not comply. They do not obey. So in this story of two fathers and three sons, Eli and his two sons being the sons, and God and Eli being the father, this is a broken one. And in the question of at what point does a... I'll just leave that for a bit. But if you look at this one, and it's broken, very dysfunctional, this is what not to do. So comparing Abraham and Isaac to this one, they're very, very different, obviously. I'll come back to that in a bit. And going to the New Testament in Luke 2, I'm just looking at father and son relationships here. In Luke 2:40, when I first studied this struck me. As I was studying it, this was what started my whole musing. In Luke 2:40, and the child grew and waxed strong in spirit, and it was filled with wisdom, Jesus, and the grace of God was upon him. So again, no conflict. He's growing in wisdom with God and man. And in verse 51, he went down with them, came to Nazareth, was subject unto them, his parents. Again, no conflict on Jesus' part. And his mother kept all these things in her heart. And Jesus increased in wisdom and stature and favor with God and man. So I want that report on my life. Young people, you want that report on your life. So what I'm talking about here is pushback. Resistance, being your own person, finding your own way. What does that mean? Where does that, how do I as a son relate to my parents? What does that look like? So in Jesus' life here, we are starting to see no tension, no conflict, no generation gap. There is harmony, there's openness, there's blessing. It's clear, it's clean, and it's right. And moving forward, we go to Mark 1:11 with Jesus' baptism. Mark 1:11. So here again, Jesus continues. He's growing up. And we see his father speaking to him at the baptism. Mark 1:11. And it came to pass in those days that Jesus came from Nazareth of Galilee and was baptized of John in Jordan, and straightway coming out of the water, he saw the heavens open and the Spirit like a dove descending upon him. And there came a voice from heaven saying, "Thou art my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased." So again, just looking at it again, overstating the point, but there is no conflict. Christ's attitude and the Father's attitude is a complete, clear, free-flowing stream of blessing, of love, of unity, of harmony. And that is what we're looking for. There is harmony. There's no tension. It's together. It's cooperation. It's unity. Love is flowing both ways. And going forward to John 5, where this got solidified in my mind, Jesus kept saying over and over and over again in his Gospels, in all four of them. Just looking at a few things here. I could have picked out many things, but I'll go through John 5 here. And look at this interchange in light of Christ's relationship to his Father. How did they operate? So I'm breaking into the story, but in John 5, Jesus answered them when they said that he healed on the Sabbath. Jesus answered them and said, "My Father worketh hitherto, and I work." So he's saying, God is working, I'm going to work. We're in complete parallel. Going to 19, "Then answered Jesus and said unto them, Verily, verily, I say unto you, the Son can do nothing of himself, but what he seeth the Father do, or whatsoever he doeth, these also the Son, do it the Son likewise." So Jesus said, whatever I see my Father doing, I'm doing the exact same thing. There's going to be no conflict between me and my Father. None. And then in verse 30, "The Father loveth the Son and showeth him all things that he himself doeth." Complete communication. "He will show him greater works than these, that you may marvel." They communicate freely back and forth. "For as the Father raiseth up the dead and quickeneth them, even so the Son quickeneth whom he will." We work together, we are together, there is no pushback. "For the Father judgeth no man, but committeth all judgment unto the Son. How my Father will judge, I will judge." He's not going to do this, and I do that. Again, absolute harmony. "That all men should honor the Son, even as they honor the Father. If you give honor to one, you can do the exact same thing to the Father. He that honoreth not the Son, honoreth not the Father." Complete harmony. Verse 24, verily I say unto you, he that heareth my word and believeth on him that hath sent me hath everlasting life and shall not come into condemnation, but is passed from death unto life. So even there, it's salvation with God, it is with Christ. And then there's many more, but I'll just read one more. For as the Father hath life in himself, so hath he given it to the Son to have life in himself. Okay, I feel like I'm overstating the point, but I'm doing it on purpose. So imagine this scenario. Jesus has wild shoes on that are completely inappropriate for his Jewish culture. And Joseph, his father, says to him, we don't appreciate your shoes as a culture. Can you imagine in your wildest imagination Jesus saying, what's wrong with the shoes? It is such a weird concept. I think if he had had anything that was out of line with his father or with his earthly father, the point would not have been, what's wrong with that, like, push? That would absolutely not have been there. It would have been, is this causing conflict between the flow that I need to happen? Burn the shoes. I'm sorry they were ever there. Out. So that aspect of absolute harmony and the example that Christ lived day by day by day with his Father, that absolute commitment to absolute harmony is astounding. Because he had a daily life to live. He lived like we did. So if you look at the little issues and saying, what's wrong with this? Well, is it better? Is that right? Am I right? Child, does a three-year-old obey? Am I too strict? If you look at those situations, it can get murky. But if you look at a heart that will say, like the song is saying, guide me with thine eye. That is a request from a father to a son. And you do get guidance with the eye. It's not a beating. It's a guiding. And you look at a heart that will sit under that, and there's tension and conflict. The immediate response is, there's tension, there's conflict. How do I get out of this tension and conflict? What needs to go? What attitude do I need to change? How do we get this clear flow happening again? That is God's heart. That is what God meant with parent-child relationship. So how does that translate? Turning a corner a little bit to more of a philosophy of training. How I would see it, again, this is not necessarily Bible, it's more of a philosophy I talked about last time. Parent-child relationships for a child, teen, young adult, how does this look? And going back to, for those that weren't here, so we have three rings, thinking of horse training. One is about a 20-foot corral ring with fence posts. One is a 3-foot tight dirt circle. And one is a 5/8 mile track. So if you think of horse training, basically step one is to take a green, unridden horse and simply put a rope on it and have him walk in a circle in simple obedience. And once he gets it that we don't need to fight the rope, you're not going to die, take it easy, the horse eventually learns to simply circle and obey. Led by a rope, stop, start, put a saddle on him, don't buck, just the simple process of obedience. And I think that's young in children that would probably translate to, I think, 1, 2, 3, 4 to get the basic, this is what's expected of you, just do it, you're not going to die. It's a good thing, I'm not going to hurt you, but you will need to do this way. That's young. Training ring, 20-foot ring. And later on, as things get more directed and a horse does not obey, the rider can take the rein and pull it tight and bring the neck all the way around to the shoulder, and the horse circles in a tight 3-foot circle, and when it wants to be going forward, it's very, very annoying for the horse, and it figures out, if I want out of this 3-foot circle, I simply need to obey. I need to settle down. I need to stop bucking. I need to stop doing my own thing. The rider is in control. Right, let's do it your way. And then the 3-foot circle is released, and the horse is then set to go. And after that process, you get into the 5/8 mile track, which the horse was made to do, was bred to do. There were maybe millions of dollars put into it to simply run. It was made to run. It wants to run. Every fiber of its being is to run, be fast, and be good, and be the best. And as it follows that training procedure, if it comes to the place of the 5/8-mile track, and all of a sudden the horse would decide to just, you know what, this has been good, but I don't like this anymore, and he starts weaving, and he's finding himself here, diagonally facing the wall. Well, it's just not supposed to be that way. This history is behind us. We went through this one ring, we went through the second ring. This is where it's meant to, we're meant to run here. So to get a $2 million horse that's just facing the fence, you're missing it. This is not at all how it's supposed to be. And then what do you do with it? Do you, like, in a race, do you restart? Do you, like, it gets complicated because it's just weird. It's just not supposed to be that way. And sometimes with relationships, they're just so wrong that it's hard to, from the original, it's hard to know what to do with it. It's like rolling a car down a hill and then calling BMW and saying, how do we fix this? BMW might have some advice, but it wasn't supposed to be rolled down the hill. So I don't know if you, do you cut the door off? Do you bend it? I'm not sure. Like, this isn't really, there's no super plan for this because it's out of what we had in mind. So I think parenting, our relationship with God, sometimes there's places that we're so far off track that it's, if you don't get the big picture, I'm not sure if I can help you. You need to back off and, like, at what point does a young person just simply blindly submit? At what point, like, those things are, you need to have the big picture of harmony, unity, what it's supposed to be like to deal with the small issues, and they become a lot clearer. So if the horse fights the trainer, whether early or late, the main purpose is undermined. The trainer's vision is to make the horse, like I said before, the best, the fastest, the most fulfilled, and the greatest that it can be. So in training, the methods might not be understood. And usually if there's somebody to yield, the trainer will typically be right. So in our case, if there's something to be altered, it's us. It's not God that needs to change. If we're in conflict, very likely we're, or in God's case, we are wrong. We need to adjust. Typically in a parent-child relationship, it'll be the children that need to adjust because the trainer is guiding, meaning he's resisting what the horse or the child would naturally want. But it has to be understood, unity is the key, harmony is the key. And once trust is built, it gets easier and easier. You know what, we did this yesterday, the rope got put on, it wasn't bad, it worked, it's fine. And you've got that history and you keep doing it, eventually it's like, put on the rope, I actually enjoy the circle thing, I get to run, rather than standing in a stall. And as time goes on, I think trust is built and things just start working once people understand what's happening. So when you train a two-year-old, where are we headed? What's behind the no-no? The come to daddy, you have to obey, look at me when I'm talking to you. What is behind that? Is it just to make life flow better? On one hand, yes, but it's a big picture. Obey. Not my will, but thine be done. Where did we hear those words? So a two-year-old needs to understand that mindset. Not my will, but thine be done, because at the end of the day, it's God's world. We're God's children. Like Christ, we say, not my will, but thine be done. But if a child has a completely untrained, people say broken, I don't think broken is the right word, I think it's trained, untrained will, it can't go right. They can't reach adulthood with a completely willful brain and listen to God and saying, not my will, but thine be done. It won't happen. Because what's set, train up a child in the way he should go, when he's old, he will not depart from it. The principle of obedience has to be there. You have to understand that there's something bigger than me. If I obey, whether I see it or not, it'll very likely be better for me long term. And that's the point. So, question for you and question for me. Can you obey a command or an order when somebody says to you, or God says to you, stop doing that? Just like that. Or can you obey a request? I mean, where your heart, well, actually, it was going this way, and it stops, and it turns. Can you obey a request? If you get, I would appreciate if, more subtle things in God's word, or from your parents, or from your authorities. So one is a command or an order. One is a request. One is a desire, the next one. It would be nice if, that's a lot softer. But it's still direction. Now imagine Jesus taking it would be nice if from his father. What would his response be? Absolute obedience, absolute harmony, absolute unification. What my Father wants, I do. If God says it would be nice if, Christ's response, we have no question what it would be. And I think if God gives Abraham a it would be nice if, we know what Abraham's response is, we know what Isaac's response would have been. Now looking at Samuel or Eli and his sons, what would they do with the it would be nice if? It's like, pfft. That was their response. Or on the next level, and I think is the best of all, an honor. If you know from somebody, from God, from your parent, from your authority, from your church, an honor, if you know that somebody's heart is, and I've heard this, I've heard language like this here, so we know what this means, my heart would be that. So in other words, I'm not commanding you. I'm not even saying that you need to, but my heart would be that, and a father will express what he would like to see. There's very little pressure there on one hand, but if you look at Christ's example and he gets a, my heart would be that, what would Christ do in that situation? We know what he would do. And it is like, it's like the situation from the clock tower. If you would say that, can it, again, I'm picking low-hanging fruit. Can a father say to a son, no to those shoes? Well, if you look at the individual, are they bad shoes? Are they really so far out? Are they comfortable? Were they cheap? You can look at those things and it gets a bit gray. But look at Christ's example. And if his father had said to him, I don't want those shoes, what would Christ's example be? And for me, if you look at this situation, this is a sniper in a clock tower saying, not sure, well, what about this, what about that? If you look at Christ's example, is there's a 6-inch, 900-pound shell on the whole situation. If God would have said to Jesus, no shoes, we know what the answer would have been. Like, it's finished. Absolutely finished. Christ's answer would have been what we know it would be. So a defiant child, young, medium, old, a willful teen, an irresponsible parent, they're all the same thing. They're a brokenness in the conduit of blessing. They're a blockage in the channel of love, harmony. It's just blocked. It's broken. It's not meant to be that way. What is meant to flow back and forth is not happening. So in the horse illustration, nobody wins if the horse starts challenging. Nobody, not the trainer, not the horse, not the crowd, nobody wins that situation. It's not supposed to be that way. It's not what was designed to be. And if you go to original design, then you start understanding, wow, this is great. That thing can run. As opposed to looking at another one, beating the wall. Yes, he's being independent. Yes, he's expressing himself. Yes, he's having his own way. Yes, he's having doubts about his trainer. But all that is aside. Look at the one that's running and then go with that one. Look at what could be. And that's what I want to do with Christ's life. Not get mired in the detail, but the big picture. So translation, again, young people. Let's say it this way. I'll give another illustration in a minute here. But a young person, you just got a phone, and your parents said, we'll see how it goes. We'll monitor it. Maybe you're 15, 16, 17, 18. So young person, you just got a phone. We're going to see, we're going to work on trust and see how you handle it, see what happens with it, screen time, content, how much we text people, how much we're sucked into that world. How are you handling it? And it seems to be going pretty well. For the first few months, there's things to talk about and touch on and work on, but the guidance is happening. And after a year, things look pretty good. And the dad has a mental, this is about what I had in mind. And then the child with the phone after a year gets found out. There was lots of stuff happening. There were lots of deleted things, lots of chats that were hidden, maybe an app that hid things completely. There are apps like that, by the way, that you can have entire photo albums that are hidden. If you shake the phone a certain way, they disappear into nowhere, so your parent can't check up on it. That stuff is all built in by the devil to kill Christian homes, I think, or any home. But anyways, the child gets found out too. After a few months, he got into stuff that he should not have been. And the dad finds this out, not by confession, but just, bang, something happened and he got busted. So if you look at that year, I'll put in a different perspective. What happened there? So in child-parent relationship, it's sort of like this, and this is not a perfect illustration. It might be a breakdown legally, but just hear me out. So imagine that you're you did something that you weren't supposed to do. Maybe you robbed a bank, and the people got hurt in that robbery. It wasn't meant to be that way, but it did. And it was a bad situation. And you're on trial. You have a lawyer, and you're sitting down with him for the first time. So there's a lawyer-client privilege that whatever I or you say to the lawyer, he's sealed. He doesn't need to tell anybody. He doesn't need to tell the police, hey, do you know what my client did? He's toast. Like, the lawyer does not have to give up anything that we say in that meeting. In other words, he's your friend, he's your ally, you need him. So he's saying, all right, we're here, closed office. You probably were there, what happened? And you tell the lawyer what happened, because we're gonna make, whatever the situation is, we're gonna make the best case scenario of it. So maybe you tell him that, yes, I was part of the robbery, but I was not part of that situation because I was over here and so on. And you give him a story and the lawyer says, okay, well, we're gonna work with this. I think we can do so-and-so and we'll plead this and we'll cast doubt on this guy's testimony because we need this to happen. So you've told me everything, like, this is it, this is what we're working with, this is what's on the table, and you say, yep, that's it, let's work with it. And you make a plan, you go to court, and the prosecution gets up and starts asking you things, and you answer back pretty much to the story of what you told the lawyer. But at a certain point, the prosecution says, okay, evidence P7, video from this camera, and you're shown to be in a place where you had told your lawyer you were not. And all of a sudden, things are very, very different. The lawyer at that point, your lawyer, sits back in his chair, folds his arms, because he knows you're pooched, you're done. The very person that should have helped you, if you had told me this thing, we could have worked with it. But you held it from me, your lawyer, lawyer-client privilege. Had you told me you were there, I would have guided it differently, would have made it work. But because you withheld that information from you, from me, you're done. Like, I'm finished. Like, whatever happens in the next day or so, my job's finished. I did what I could till this exact moment. And when I found out that we're not in harmony, when that happens, that breaks, we're toast. And he knows it. You might not, but he does. So he sits back, and whatever happens is his, this is a lost case, we're done. So looking back to the phone situation, you as a young person maybe got away with a year of hiding and sneaking and going around your dad. But from the dad's perspective, if after that year he finds out that it's been absolutely not what he thought, that conduit that he thought was clear and clean is icky, that's a big problem. And had the young person said, hey, I got problems with my phone at month number 3, and gone to the dad, and that channel is still open, we're still communicating, that's fixable. We can work with that. We can do that. Because it's my job to make it good, make it better, get the best solution that we can. But as soon as that's broken, lawyer-client situation is damaged, not functioning like it should, you're done. So with that, did you get away with a year of stuff? Maybe. Was it worth it? And the damage it did? Not even close. No chance. So the right thing to do would have been work with your father. It happened. It's tough. But we need harmony. We need clarity. We need unity. We can meet. We can talk. We can work with this. So a lawyer says, I was your ally. Your dad would say, I was your ally. I was your teammate, the one person that could have helped you. You shot yourself in the foot. Don't do that. It's not meant to be like that. You did not win. That year of misplaced trust, it's not over, but it's just damaged tremendously from what could have been and what should have been. It's very hard to build that year of trust back. I don't think that will ever be at a place where it could have been had it been clean and clear. So you're looking for harmony, you're looking for help, you're looking for clarity. Be open and honest with us and God and our children. It's all the same thing. We process anything. Hide it, mistrust, broken things, it can be guaranteed it will be to our hurt. So the question is asked, how old is too old? How old is too old for that thing to be there? And I put the question there on purpose because the very question shows lack of vision for what's supposed to be. If you want out of that, at what age was Jesus too old to be out of his father's direction? 18? Should God have, okay, Jesus, you're a big boy now, make your own decisions. Jesus, I'm stepping out from this blessing channel because I'm 18? That's a weird concept. Guidance? I'm 19. I'll need guidance at 19. I don't want to step out at 18. So the very question, how old is too old for that channel to not be there? There isn't a too old. If a 9-year-old had a dad, I'm assuming he'd want wisdom from his dad if he was still alive. So to say at 18 you cut and then you do your thing, that's totally missing the point. And going back to Eli's negative example, I'd like to look at that. This has been a deep conviction for me. So going back to 2 Samuel, the what not to do scenario, I just want to give you God's viewpoint on that, just to further the point. So in 1 Samuel again, God had a firm opinion on that. He spoke to Samuel. So Samuel did rebuke his sons, but God spoke to him, and this was God's viewpoint when he spoke to Samuel. He said, I have told him that I will judge his house forever because he knew what they did, and because it made themselves vile, and he restrained them not. So God said, Eli, this old man, did not restrain his sons. Eli did say, why are you doing that? God's viewpoint was, you did nothing with them. You have serious consequences. And I don't know what that does to you, to your father heart. So we can say Eli tried, but God said it was your responsibility to deal with it. God said. That is very, very, very sobering. These were adult men, priests, probably married, probably with families, in official positions. But God's viewpoint was, Sam or Eli, I will deal with you and your house forever because you did not deal with the responsibility that was legitimately yours. And Eli did talk to them, but he did not handle the situation in a way that God put in his place. It's very, very sobering. God held Eli to account for only talking to and not actually acting with his adult sons, priests. And again, how is this done? It kind of goes back to, like, how would Eli as an old man have dealt with his sons? Again, it gets very awkward because it's just absolutely not supposed to be that way. You're rolling a car down the hill, you're calling BMW for help. It's not supposed to be that way. It's not going to be a clean, easy, tidy solution. But the fact is, God's viewpoint still is God's viewpoint. It's the father's responsibility to deal with things that are in his plate. The expectation was there by God that the authority was firmly in place. I think that's clear, and it should have been looked after. And the key to all of that is to make the point is not to shame Eli or anything like that. It's to say that it's a father's responsibility to guide so that the forward vision is all the way through. We're not only wanting obedient 2-year-olds and obedient 9-year-olds and obedient 11-year-olds and the release at 16. The channel of blessing is from 2 to 60. And it does not end, and I believe it does not even change. The channel of blessing, obedience, and harmony. Now, to say that a father will boss a person of different age differently, if you can put it that way, maybe. But the point is harmony between the two, completely. So on the positive, we have God, Jesus aside. When Jesus was too old, God would not have said to the 18-year-old Jesus, okay, that's that. We're done. Jesus at 30 said, I do nothing but what my father tells me. Again, I say that again because it struck me so much. So when we look at what can be and what should be and how things are meant to be, in our world, it's extremely dysfunctional. Things just spiral to nothing, to nowhere, to such a low level that it's hard to even grasp this concept maybe in our practical world. We're used to damage and brokenness and dysfunction. But going back to, I will guide thee with mine eye, there's phrases that are pretty common in our culture, maybe not verbally, but the attitude. You still listen to your dad? Your parents won't find out. Or this one, my parents don't want me to, but insinuating I'll proceed anyway. Or this one, it's not their business, to an authority. look at Christ's example. When people say it's all about Jesus, and when I say that Jesus is the answer, look at this one. Would Jesus have ever, 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 ever said to his authority, it's not their business? Again, when you put it that way, it's the 6-inch shell on the tower. Jesus would never, ever, ever say to his authority, it's not your business. Never. And that is what we're looking for between our relationships, between our authorities. I make my own decisions. In other words, I'm a man now. Was Jesus a man? Yes, he was. The best man ever. The noblest man ever. The purest, the most blessed man. So a parent has a very serious charge, a call, a duty, an obligation. I read that too fast for what's in here. A parent has a very serious charge, call, duty, obligation to lead the right way, fathers, so that those wanting to obey can do so without chaos and confusion. Parents, that's on us. Your leading is critical. A general in wartime, who's heard about the raid at Dieppe in France? Anybody? Second World War. It was one of the most catastrophic, just ill-fated missions pretty much of the whole entire war. There were a number of things that happened there. It wasn't planned super well. They met unexpected events. The weather wasn't ideal. But just the whole raid on Dieppe was catastrophic, humiliating, tremendous loss of life. So the English tried to cross the English Channel and enter a port of Dieppe, and it just went disastrous. So there were thousands of lives lost or prisoners of war taken, but the generals that called it, that planned it, even though there were individual lives there, the generals called it, and it was their responsibility. Somebody said, we're doing this. Somebody made the call, we're going at this time. Somebody said, we're going to need 5,000 men. Somebody said, we're sending 25 ships, whatever the case is. Somebody at the top planned that thing, but it was the ones underneath that paid it. And war is generally like that. Even though it was individual people, a brother, an only son, a son of five, a dad, killed, individuals. So my point is this, a general may give a command, but it's an absolute awful place to be in to have to do that. We're going to be losing 20,000 men today, but we have to go take the hill. And in the same way, the parent, I believe, has a very serious charge to lead correctly. And it's a big deal, but I believe God will help us to do what we need to so that those that are in our care can walk in ways that are beautiful. Very sobering as a parent. So the leaders have a responsibility of thousands of lives, and the thousands of lives are expected to obey because things will go well because their commanders know what they're doing. Very serious. So what I'm saying is a parent by order of authority is bound by their authority, God, to be responsible to their place and lead in a way that is genuinely for the best of the children. It's not a power trip. It's not dad dominates. It's not he wants his own will. That's not what it's about. It's how God set things up. It's not self-serving. It's not lording it over. It's not dominating. It's not bullying. It's leading to the right way. The end. That's what it's about to parent. You do your best. Trust and obey how things are meant to be. So to understand authority is to understand a very, very big part of God's way. I'm going to go to Philippians 2, and I've looked at that so many times as well, but if you look at it in light of Christ, I want to do that again. He is the absolute example of how to be, how things can be, how things should be. So Philippians 2, I think I'll for sake of time not go there, we're familiar with it, but how he obeyed his father. This is that. Harmony. And so if we get directives, be it our shoes, our curfew, our books, our media, our music, put them in light of Christ's example for everybody, old or young, from age 5 to 70. Put those things in Christ's perspective. So teens, understand and work with parents instead of pushing. The pushing aspect, expressing yourself, it isn't the Bible. It's not here, I'll say it that way. The expressing yourself, to be your own person, be an individual, stand up for yourself, be a man, that language is just not here. It isn't. And I challenge you young people, be somebody that will say, my culture is this, maybe even my peers are this, I don't know. But I, for one, am going to be one that will be so solidly in God's way, or at least I'm going to do whatever I can. So going back to the shoe thing, my dad has a problem with shoes. I don't want the shoes if it's going to cloud my relationship. And then a dad can also say, these shoes aren't a big deal. They were cheap. They were da-da-da. Whatever. Maybe it's just shoes. And that's his call. But the thing is, that flow is there. That communication, that harmony is unbroken. So clean. The point is this. My whole point for all of us is this. Harmony. How clean and clear can we make this thing? I love that statement. In our relationships, how clean and clear can we make this thing? Is this an issue? Is this an issue? Is this an issue? Okay, we got the junk out. This feels a lot better. And maybe the dad will say, no, actually, this wasn't bad. Let's put this back in. It's still clean and clear, but there's communication. So we obey and we trust. So just finishing up here, to see the wisdom of God, to see the rightness of God, to see the blessing of God, to have harmony with God and man, obedience is vital. The better and clearer we can work with God for his purpose in our life, in our world, the more fulfilled we will be, because that's what we were made to do. This is our very creation point. It's why we are here, to show the wisdom of God, the righteousness of God, the blessing of God, the harmony of God. And if you look at what Jesus accomplished with his life by simply obeying, it's astounding. Do you want the life that's useful? We do. So in 1 John 5, I read this last time as well, 1 John 5:1-3, I love these verses. Whosoever believeth that Jesus Christ is born of God, and everyone that loveth him that begat, loveth him also that is begotten of him. By this we know that we love the children of God, when we love God and keep his commandments. For this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments, and his commandments are not grievous. So if somebody's saying to you, you obey God, you have to obey everything he says, you're missing the point. I love to obey God. I was reading in Psalms today. There were many points. I love your law. I love your precepts. They are life unto me. That's a different attitude than you got to obey your parents. You're missing it. If that's your attitude, you're missing it totally. Those that love the commandments and love God, keep them, because that's where the blessing is. That's where the channel of life is. That's a challenge to parents and to children. It applies to all of us. So I would challenge all of us to look at Christ's example in our life with submission, with honor, with authority. And if you look at the one thing that Jesus was absolutely grieved about, it's heartrending in a way, but when he cried, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? When you think of the relationship he had, he said over and over, I do nothing without my Father. And then to come to a place where God is not there anymore, that must have been so awful. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? When that channel was broken and disconnected, it was, I think, one of the hardest things for Christ to process, if not the hardest thing, a separation from that clear channel of working together. So the challenge is this. What is the standard of normal in our mind? Did we accept what's there out in our world, or do we take the Bible's way, God's way, and saying this is normal? So let's not take what's normal in our world. That's generally rubbish. That mindset is not in the Bible. If we take God's way, that's where life and blessing is. What is normal in our mind? In our worlds, the statements that I made, if somebody says to you the things that I said, you be a man, you're listening to your parents, those things, look at Christ. What do we want with our relationship, with our authorities? What do we accept as normal with our relationship with God? Do we need God to say, you will not? Or do we want God to say, my heart would be that? And then we're moved by that. We respond. So I think I'll just close there. I want to pray before we do that. God, we want to commit ourselves to you again. We are your children. We want to be that. We want to be noble and clear with our relationship with you, and to trust you and love you, that your love can go to us. I pray that we can be submitted to you, that you would work with us, that you would love us, that you would father us, that you would discipline us as needed, not for your pleasure, but for our benefit, and that we can freely work with you and understand that you love us. It's your care that guides us, and that you simply want the best, and that we can understand that, and that we can love and shepherd our children as such, and be parents that would give them that gift of guiding in the right way. Forgive us our failings, God, in whatever way that it is, and give us grace to live in your manner, in your way, in your kingdom, and what things can and should be. Amen.